Scott Wood's interview with Meltzer from about 2000, and that's where I found out Meltzer was in Portland. I could check Wikipedia, they might tell us.
That's right. No, I'm pretty sure he's still there. So.
And what's the, I'm on page three, I don't want to go back to page one. What was the book that he had written just then? A Whole Lot of Shit or something?
A Whore Just Like the Rest.
Oh, yeah.
And that's an anthology. It wasn't new material. It's basically his career compendium.
Right, and that's the one that got the glowing reviews.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to get out my articles. Did I send you the Earl Scott North to the audio of that interview we did 10 years ago?
No. I downloaded it and just did a search for it and
because
found
it. I gave you Scott's name, so then you just looked it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the email.
So I told you that Scott sent me some articles, a whole bunch of good articles, and I went through them. And so, Scott Woods, are you going to lead with issues or things in those articles? Is that how we start?
Well, what I thought, Bob, was I had a few sort of, just a few kind of more general sort of questions I wanted to lead off with, and then we'll go right into the pieces themselves. And a lot of my sort of quote-unquote questions, they don't all sort of end with a question mark, you know what I mean? It's like I'm kind of like tossing out a quote or an idea from some of the stuff I sent you and just, you know, sort of take it from there, I think.
So. Oh, okay. So you have a direction, a beginning point you want to start with?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Is this an interview for Rock Critics or something?
I'd like it to be, yeah.
Is that still going? Yeah, I think it is. It is.
It's going, but it's not sort of going with the same exuberance as it was 5-6 years ago. It's kind of like, it's kind of devolved a little bit into just sort of another blog out there that occasionally, you know, pops its head up and says something, but it's not something I put a hell of a lot of my energy into the way I used to. So
rockcritics.com was your baby. You created that.
That's correct, yeah.
And you got all those people who do interviews of other people. You organized all that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like, you know, that vast a network in some ways. I mean, it is with the interviewees, but there was really one guy who kind of... I had posted a few things online in what was a magazine called Popped, and that's what your thing was actually in. It was initially in a thing called Popped.
And that wasn't your magazine?
No, that was mine as well, but that was more sort of... That was just kind of trying a lot of different things related to music. It wasn't specifically critic-related, but then I did do an interview with Frank Hogan, I did one with Chuck Eddy, and then I did one with you, and I think I did those three, and this guy named Stephen Ward from the States said, look, I'm really into Rock Critics. I want to get this interview with this guy, Paul Nelson, who's considered one of the originators of the forum. Would you want to do something with it? And right away I thought, you know, I should actually just start a website about it, and I want to call it rockcritics.com because it kind of was an obnoxious name and stuff, so.
You mean Popped was an obnoxious name?
Not as much, no. I mean, Rock Critics, I honestly, like, from the minute I thought of the name, I thought, oh, God, some people are just going to kind of, like, sort of croak when they hear that name. Because, you know, everyone kind of loves to hate Rock Critics kind of thing, and it just sounds so kind of obnoxious, and I thought, perfect. That's just kind of what I wanted to do. So.
Oh, okay. You liked that it was obnoxious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you probing? Were you interviewing rock critics, or were you a critic in the rock business?
It was really about wanting to talk to the writers about the writing and about their ideas. It was never a site that...
The songwriters?
No, rock, to actual rock critics, so yeah. People who write about rock and roll and stuff and pop music. But the thing is, it was never, like, the intention was to never sort of, like, run a record review or anything like that on the site. I wanted to, you know, that just kind of didn't interest me. It's more like, no, I want to talk to sort of some of the intellects of, you know, what I consider the, you know, music writing and just find out what it is about them, what they do, that kind of thing, so...
That's interesting, because you're creating kind of a metasphere for the... I mean, the rock critics are creating a sphere, and they have readers, and then you're creating, like, a metasphere where you're interviewing the rock critics.
It really is. It's and that's, you know, kind of an, in some ways, in some people's minds, certainly, it's another layer of the obnoxiousness. But it's an obnoxiousness. I mean, that's the negative slant on it. I believe in like an intellectual approach to pop music and to rock and roll. So I want to hear what these people have to say. And you know, the funny thing is, I didn't really do that many of the interviews myself. I maybe did between 12 and 15, whereas, you know, I had this other guy from the U.S., Stephen Ward, probably conducted like 50 interviews. He was just all over the map getting everyone. So,
Is he still alive today?
Yeah, he's still around.
you guys were in a sense cross-pollinating the rock critics out there, because they started probably finding out what they thought about each other or getting...
Exactly.
Also, your generation, rock critics had the best and interesting writers for you, for a young mind. And so they were your heroes, in a way, the better ones.
Absolutely. I grew up in the early to mid-70s. You know, I was born in 64. So I was kind of latching on to this stuff, really, I mean, almost maybe in some people's minds a little after the peak or whatever. Well, I don't even know if I want to say the peak. That's a thorny issue altogether, but... But really, in the sort of one of the heydays of the form, the mid-70s, early 70s, especially with Cream magazine and that sort of thing, Cream was like my Bible as a kid, basically. Even though I didn't really understand what some of these writers were actually saying, like Lester Bangs was as big an idol to me at one point as, you know, the Stones or Roxy Music or the New York Dolls or something. He was part of that. He was as much rock and roll as any of those guys were. So, and that, you know, that is often sort of thought of as the quote-unquote golden age. So, yeah, I mean, all the sort of intellectual ideas that have sort of driven rock criticism really did kind of come out of that period, from Richard Meltzer to Greil Marcus to Lester Bangs, Robert Christgau, all those guys.
Yeah, now I was reading Cream since it started, and I knew Lester Bangs, and it's interesting, you know, you're born 40 years after me, and we're both reading the same stuff, at least by the late 70s. You start reading when you're 11 or 12?
Yeah, when I was about 11 or 12, I would say I was looking at Cream and getting off on some aspect of it, and like, you know, reading some of it but not totally grasping it.
Yeah.
But working at it, and then eventually, you know, probably started to kind of make sense more, like, you know, when punk hit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Now, look at that, Scott. You got me working with the World CIA looking at Cream.
Well, what's interesting to me, Bob, is that you've got the curiosity of a 12-year-old or the disposition.
No. We're not. This is the point. So I just wanted to finish the thought, then say that. Here you have this global language, rock, and it's totally McLuhan what he's saying. It involves everybody. So all ages are reacting to it, and you wanted to know what was going on, you'd look at Cream, you know, better than Rolling Stone. And the thing is, we were all involved in it, so we were all 1 year old. That's part of the points I would make about all this, you know?
Yeah.
And look at this. That was the inspiration for Scott. You know, he's got a good mind. And then you have, back in the 20s, no 12-year-old was reading T.S. Eliot. But you see, it's a different kind of culture when all ages of sophistication are looking at the same phenomenon.
Yeah, well, yeah, but not everyone. I mean, my folks weren't not into Cream.
No, but I mean, well, the baby boomers on. Hmm. And yeah, you had to be curious. Not many people. There were a few people reading Cream that I knew of that were younger than me, but I knew from reading it that there were kids all over the world reading it.
Yeah.
On the letters.
Sure, and I mean, to Scott's point, kind of, it certainly wasn't everyone reading it, obviously.
No.
You knew you could, I mean, Cream, the interesting thing about Cream, I don't know if you remember, Bob, but you mentioned the letters. They had, like, one of the greatest letter sections ever, but they used to print tons of letters from Canada, and they would always kind of make fun of Canada and mock Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of like a neat connection for me, too. It kind of gave me this, like, hey, it's kind of cool to make fun of Canada, like, you know what I mean? It was just sort of undercut all the other information you get about growing up in Canada. It was like, like, we're ridiculous. You know what I mean? It was very fun.
Yeah, it was a more regular National Lampoon, Priest, Church of Subgenius.
Yeah.
The whole sensibility was there. And the thing is, you know, the kids who were inclined to thinking, to be nerdy intellectuals or something, in the teens and 20s, they read T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound or something. You have to understand that that kind of kid would read Cream, and writing was pretty obsolete, but that's the closest you'd get for that light left hemisphere kind of activity. You know what I mean? For a young, smart kid would go to there. That's where it was, which is pretty interesting, eh?
Yeah. And how would they get it back then? I mean,
you mean in the 20s?
Yeah.
No, they wouldn't.
They wouldn't get it.
They wouldn't. An intellectual kid might be reading Trollope or Charles Dickens or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
They wouldn't know about Eliot and Pound and that. It'd be too sophisticated, too adult, too much separation. But music drops all those literary categories, literary age differences. I mean, that's what McLuhan said. We went from adolescence to being teenagers. Teenagers are just another part of the global market.
Right.
And so teenagers, and then music, it wasn't literary. It was reacting to the news, and rock music was reacting to the news, and then the kids would try to find out what was happening. It's a total sensibility that is defined by McLuhan in the broadest terms.
And the satellite allowed us to mix it up.
Yeah. So I remember, Scott, you told me, or Neufeld told me, you said this. No, I think you told me. It might even be in the interview in the History of Rock and Roll.
Right.
You felt depressed. It was just too much of a leviathan negativity implied by what I was saying. You remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that, actually. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like getting run over by a train in a way.
Yeah.
It was just like, even though I kind of, like, I had actually been tuning into your CKLN stuff for a long time before that. Like, I think, you know, you hadn't been on CKLN in a long time around that time, or
no.
I wasn't hearing it. But you know, Dave and I became friends in around 83, 84, we went to Ryerson. He turned me on to the Bob stuff, CKLN, I guess more like sort of 87, 88. I used to tune in quite regularly. So it was kind of like, I think I knew what to expect from that interview, but it still completely sort of upended everything.
Right. So, and I think it's really great that I'm in there with Lester Bangs or Meltzer and all those people you interviewed. I mean, no one else would have done that. I'd never be put in there. But I think that that interview is really good, and what I'm going to do tonight is going to be amazing.
Excellent. Well, on that point, I want to get Bob Dobbs. Like, it sounds weird, but I've never received any commentary from other critics about that, and I want to right that wrong.
Yeah, and
I kind of go into that just a bit in some of the questions, but you know, I see so many affinities in stuff that I've been hearing you say over the years, especially with some of the Meltzer stuff, and that's why particularly I wanted to send you quite a bit of his stuff, but. I want to get Bob out there to do that for him.
Yeah, I think, and I agree, because I have Meltzer's Aesthetics of Rock. I have Gulcher, but they're in Connecticut in a warehouse. I have not looked at them in 30 years.
Wow.
And it was so awesome to reread Bangs and Meltzer and Marcus and all these guys who were a part of my life a long time ago. You know what I mean? And it's holy shit, there's a whole flashback. And I said, I think we can wrap this up. We can correct it. We can point out what Meltzer and I were fucking trying to talk about, you know?
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you sending these articles. They're really fun reading them. And you'll see, Scott, this is it's going to be pretty interesting. I'm going to explain their generation to themselves.
Okay. I believe it, okay.
Yeah. Because, if you know a bit about what I said, and then you start looking at what they're saying, they give the details proving my broader map. They prove my broader map of what I'm saying. They just haven't had the big map explained to them. So that's, and we didn't have that in the first interview. I haven't looked at it, so I can't remember.
You know, for some reason in that first interview, the one thing I remember prior to it was, I think I kind of chicken shit it out a little bit in that I remember at one point thinking, you know, I kind of want to ask Bob what he might think of Meltzer and maybe reading back some quotes or something like that. But I just didn't have this confidence in thinking about and talking about rock critics back then, as weird as it sounds. So it's kind of like I shied away from it. I thought, well, you know, I want to hear what Bob just has to say about rock and roll in general and about, you know, the history of the music and all that sort of stuff. So, no, I'm thrilled to be having this conversation.
Yeah,
today.
This is going to be part two. And you're saying that you could have, you had Meltzer quotes in mind back then.
Yeah, well, I was really into that. That was shortly after that's probably about 10 years after the time I really got into aesthetics of rock, so it had been on my plate for a while. And, I mean, I think I sort of made connections between some of what Meltzer was saying and some of what I hear you say, like, for a long time, but it's something I just kind of kept to myself for whatever reason.
And then
it's really what sort of spurred
was
this.
Bob and Ben.
Bob and Ben, absolutely. Like, I'd hear you guys talk about particular things, and sometimes I'd be like, I want to insert Meltzer into these guys' conversations. That's kind of what I was thinking. Like, I want to get Meltzer in there somehow.
Yeah, and I had forgotten Meltzer's writing. I haven't read him in 30 years. And Scott Norris is the greatest fan of Bob and Ben, so we have two Scots who are fans of Bob and Ben. Right, Scott
Excellent.
Norris?
Yeah, I have no way to measure that because I don't know who all is listening, but I'm definitely expressed my fanship.
Would you say you don't know who's listening? What did you just say, Scott?
Yeah, well, you know, they're, for all I know, I don't know who's listening. There could be a bigger fan than me.
No, but you like it. You really get off on it.
No,
and Ben likes
my enthusiasm.
The notes you send to him, and he's responded to them. And Scott Witz has been listening to a few. Have you caught the latest?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I caught 26, and you actually.
I mentioned you on the last show.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Meltzer stuff, which was great too. And it's funny, Bob, because you mentioned it. It was weird. I was listening to that episode, and Ben had made his comment about, you know, Rolling Stone magazine, and I really liked his comment. He was saying, you know, well, you know. The very last place I would kind of expect to find any sort of thought-provoking or however he put it, you know, interesting spin on rock and what it can be would be in Rolling Stone magazine. And then he went off in that bit. And then you kind of, and I was thinking, oh, come on, get Meltzer in here somewhere. And he came in saying, well, there's actually this guy named Richard Meltzer. And
I did it, but you won it.
I was literally thinking, I can't wait to talk to Bob because I want to get some Richard Meltzer there. But you did it. So.
Yeah, and then I took a quote from the book, or from what you sent me, and I put in another word in there, right?
You did that a few. I think that wasn't in the same episode, but yeah, you did a brilliant thing where you took. I think what you inserted in was something like, was it like Windows or something?
Facebook.
Yeah.
instead of art.
And I was, as you were saying it, I was like, wait a second. Okay. Yeah.
I actually had you in mind. I said, will Scott notice this? You know, will he catch this?
That was great.
And you did. But the amazing thing is that Meltzer, Ben is a lot like Meltzer.
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, and he doesn't know Meltzer. I said, you ever read Meltzer? No, I don't know his work. This is like we found a blind spot that really can gel a lot of stuff between me and Ben.
Yeah, no, I agree.
As a matter of fact, hopefully, Ben, he's pretty harassed with his two kids. You know, he doesn't have much time. And I can never remember, he either reads or he listens. Maybe he doesn't listen, he only reads, but you have to print it out or something like that. But hopefully he'll hear this, you know what I mean, what we do. Because it could be part of our dialogue, you know, about what we're doing with Bob and Ben, because Ben didn't know that about me, but, you know, I read critics, rock critics and all that. I'm more in his world than he would first imagine. He thinks I'm some big CIA agent, you know, that retired in Hawaii, and he doesn't know I'm still forming my band. I'm just getting started. we got the great Dave Neufeld, you know, as a backup.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, Neufeld is incredibly talented for what he does.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And you know, it was the day of your interview, I think, that I went down the basement, and Dave had the studio down there, and he played me some Scott Walker.
I remember that moment, Bob.
Oh, were you there?
I remember it crystal clear, because I know it was before we did the interview. It was the same day.
So you sat down there with us?
Yeah, you came over, you know, kind of met you and stuff, and then Dave, and, you know, we just sort of hung out for a bit, and then Dave was like, oh, yeah, you know, come down and check out the studio and stuff. And, yeah, I remember he was just blasting...
Scott Walker, not...
Montague Terrace in Blue.
Yeah, and
I mean, I know it, too, because I lived with Dave, and he blasted that song all the time, right?
Yeah, and me and Dave had the exact same kind of taste, and I said, wow, this is fantastic, Scott Walker. And, I had forgot about the Walker brothers. I didn't know what had happened to the guy. And so I bought a Scott Walker... I never buy albums, but I bought a Scott Walker album when I got home after that. And then I didn't do anything more, but I always ask Dave every now and then, what's Scott Walker doing? But Dave's the new Scott Walker, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, Dave has such a perfect pitch for the mixture of all the great stuff, from AM to FM to classical to jazz to everything. You know, it's all just...
Dave Neufeld is basically my mentor in so many areas.
Yeah.
I mean, he got me into DJing. I mean, I've been a DJ for the last 10, 15 years, and that's all because of Dave Neufeld. And,
yeah.
You know, we did a lot of music together and stuff as well. Obviously, I didn't sort of continue in that area, but I always still think him and I are going to make an album together when, you know, like I'm in my 60s and my 10-month-old daughter is grown up, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Right.
But that's the kind of relationship we have. It's like... Because he kind of says that, too. Oh, yeah, we'll still make music together, for sure. Who cares how old we are? You know, we'll make the coolest album for, like, two 65-year-olds imaginable sort of thing. So.
Right. Now, what was the name of the tavern? I was asking Jim Patterson this the other day. The tavern he DJed, the Newfie Place in Dundas and Bathurst or something, Queen?
Yeah, no, I think you're probably thinking, are you thinking the Dufferin Gate?
Yeah.
Dufferin and King. Yeah, I DJed there with him. Yeah, he got me a gig there.
Oh, okay, after he left?
No, he was still there, but he had branched out into weddings.
Right.
So he wasn't, like, I think when he started, he was Thursday to Saturday, and then suddenly he didn't really have Saturdays available. So, and I had never DJed, I think I DJed like a high school party or something. So I went and sat in with him on a couple nights, and then just sort of started. So I took over the Saturday nights, and we both did it in tandem for, I think, about 2 or 3 years, so.
Yeah, so you know the Newfie environment there, or was there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Now, so I bring that up because Jim Patterson's, he's the guy, he's Earmap, he's the manager or website manager for John Oswald, you know, Plunderphonics.
Yeah.
And he's an old C-Callan friend of ours, and he designed our How Ionic site, and so I was talking to him, and his brother runs, I think, the Paddock, and I was trying to remember whether Dave did the Paddock or not, because it's close to the Dufferin Gate, right?
Close to there, yeah.
So that's the difference. All right, Dufferin Gate, because it's on Dufferin and what, King?
Dufferin and King, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I bring that up because, okay, so Dave, so Scott Norris, Scott Woods heard the interview that I did with Dave Neufeld in October 2007 at Dave's place out in the country. And that's what got Scott Woods back in touch with me, because he thought it was so neat, and then he wanted to do a more technical interview with Dave.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that was a good interview.
Yeah, and it was so funny, like Dave's going, I mean, you said Scott Woods, that you were laughing to him, because you know Dave, he's going, Bob, no one gives a fuck about that.
I know, he says that about five times.
Yeah, well, while he's urinating and the microphone's picking it up.
And I'm saying, shut up for fuck's sake, it doesn't matter.
Oh, that's funny. I think Dave even repeated that when I first spoke to him about it, telling him I liked the interview. He's like, I don't know.
I mean, here's Dave. He's made, you know, did you hear that documentary, Scott Norris, the one on Broken Social Scene, which is the fifth phase of pop history in Canada?
No, I didn't get to hear that.
You ought to listen to it, but what's the fucking scandal? They screw Dave. They don't have him on the right albums. They talk about albums he didn't do. And Neufeld's really pissed. You know all this stuff, Scott. Would,
well,
right?
Was that because they were just disorganized? Or because...
No, they're jealous of him. Like, Dave is the Zappa of Canada. At least, I mean, not a classical composer. He might be able to do it, but just his way, he's individual, he does his own thing, and he influences so many people, and there's just no credit for it.
It's really bizarre.
Yeah, so he went and spoke at a panel. Like, I'm behind the scenes, you know, pumping him up, giving him ideas, and he spoke. Did you hear about the panel a week or so ago?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, oh, you were there?
No, I was mad I didn't go. I didn't know about it, but I read the accounts of it. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and Dave got totally screwed there, but he managed to, at least he stirred it up, and this is at the famous International Authors Festival, and the people went to the Dave panel said Dave's panel was the liveliest, because Dave brought some noise into it. You know, he started saying,
yeah,
you fucking guys ripped everybody off, and you're asshole, blah, 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 and then the famous broken social scene musicians, Kevin Drew, and these guys said, no, Dave, we're not like that. It's fantastic. I'd love to see a video of it, but it's just beginning. I'm telling Dave, he should start lecturing.
Yeah.
He could do a sub-career of going around and talking to young kids, because he's got a bit of a name, and he's got great, he can use Bob knowledge and just throw it at them and really do a good job at it.
Absolutely.
So encourage him on that. I mean, he's shy about that, and he just wants to sit there and, you know, do his music and that. I mean, he's a total real slacker. I mean, he has to have his little marijuana and get stoned, I guess, and then live in that world, but I just love his sensibility, what he hears, and what he tries to make. I mean, when I heard You've Forgot It in Purple, right? My email. It's really about me, but You Forgot It in People, when I heard that, that was one of the first, a long time since I had liked an album instinctively like that, you know, because it had such a range of things in it. And I knew it was all Dave, you know. Those guys couldn't have done that. They could play a few instruments or something, give some ideas, but Dave can tweak it.
Yeah, I know. You can hear him. He is that record, absolutely.
Yeah, and then what I loved about my interview with him, we actually figured out where it came from. The fucking guy was a kid with 100 albums since he was 9 years old or something.
Yeah.
You know, did you know that before?
I think he had told me about it, yeah. But, I mean, because we probably shared those kind of memories and stuff a few times, but...
But
yeah, it's great to hear it in an interview form.
Yeah, and to put it in order, where the guy in the apartment building gives him all these albums, he doesn't want them, and this little kid gets them and starts listening, and Dave's loving it all, you know, all the different varieties, and he's got musical ability, and it just goes step by step, logically, to what he produced.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the background, Mr. Norris, on Scott Woods. It's perfect. It's actually the same inside cult. You know, Scott Woods grew up with Neufeld, went to Ryerson. It's the same five people again, you know. Beefheart's quote, five people in the world, what, 40 people in the world, five are hamburgers. It's Bob talking to the 10 people he knows. All right, so you get that, Scott Woods, Norris?
Yeah.
Sounds good, so, yeah. Hey, before we get started, I'm just curious to know, did you used to read Ben Watson before Bob ever got involved with him, Scott?
You know, it's funny. I remember hearing about the Frank Zappa book that he did a few years ago, and I think once I saw it in a used bookstore, and I looked at it, and I just couldn't, for some reason didn't make the plunge, but I looked at it and thought, oh, this looks really intriguing. But there's something about it, I'm just not sure I'm ready to buy it yet. And then I kind of looked him up online and found out a little bit about him. And I actually read a few things which were, like, kind of heavily slagging the guy, but whatever. But I just, you know, I didn't really have an opinion one way or the other. But I thought, well, I thought if I ever do finally make it through a book on Frank Zappa, that probably would be the one I want. Because I think I used to own that one that was put out in, like, 68 or something, Bob. I don't know.
Dave Wally's book, No Commercial Potential.
I used to own it, and unfortunately it's lost. I think I had a first edition, everything, whatever. But I never read that whole thing. I liked what I'd read of it, but I always thought, you know, from what I can see in Ben Watson's book, it's definitely got this kind of multi-dimensional approach that
He goes beyond the realm of the rock critics would, well, I don't know if what I'm talking about, but he goes beyond rock. Also, you know, he's including multi-artistic synergies there, I guess.
Absolutely.
And I got excited when I heard about his book. I haven't read it, but when I started to find out some of the his motivation for writing the book, it kind of blew my mind, because he was the only other person in the world other than Bob that I've ever heard talk about Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce, and Frank Zappa in the same sentence.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, the scope of Ben's book to me is one of the best things about it.
Yeah.
And there, I mean, I think one thing you're almost going to say, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of rock critics, there's certainly a lot of readers or fans of rock critics, they look at that kind of thing and they're like, they have this kind of more pedantic...
Well, it's too intimidating,
you know,
for most people.
Stick to the music, you know,
yeah.
Talk more about the music sort of thing, but... To me, I mean, that is the music. I mean, the further out you can kind of take it, like, I mean, Ben's book and Bob and Ben on the radio have quite honestly been, I wouldn't say the first, but one of the very first things to really actually get me, like, much more interested in Zappa. Because, I mean, I think one area which I definitely have diverged in the past, Bob, is... You know, I've always had a bit of a thorny relationship with Zappa in some ways. Dave has tried in the past to kind of play me some stuff. And I did like some stuff as a kid, but it was always the really obvious kind of late 60s poppy stuff.
What did you object to? Did you ever discover what it was you objected to?
I think there was just, I mean, when I think about it now, I mean, it's probably that in some ways what I objected to in Zappa was in some ways what I objected to in Richard Meltzer when I first saw the aesthetics of rock when I was a kid. There was something kind of intimidating and kind of like a bit nasty on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And just there was just something about it that was like, it didn't feel inviting to me or something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was probably influenced by a lot what a lot of rock critics have written about Zappa over the years, because he, you know, he's definitely had it's been for the most part a pretty negative relationship. Although I think that's changed.
What's a negative relationship?
Between the critics' relationship with Frank Zappa.
With Frank Zappa, yeah.
I would say Frank Zappa almost certainly is the most major musician who has received the most bad reviews.
Yeah.
I'm a major musician.
He wanted it that way, I'm sure.
He probably did, and I understand that more about him now, but I think it was kind of Bob and Ben mixed with Ben's book that sort of, I mean, I feel like I'm kind of starting to cross that line a little bit now, and I've been listening to a lot more Zappa in the last 6 months or so. And I mean, I always liked the Mother stuff. My brother used to have this Verve Greatest Hits album. It was like not really a legitimate Frank Zappa album in some ways. It was just like, you know, if there was such a thing as Frank Zappa making top 40 records, this would have been it. It had like Wowie Zowie and all that kind of stuff on it. So as a kid, I liked that stuff. But when it was more into the 70s stuff, I remember just like, there's nothing inviting here for me or something.
No.
Like,
well, one...
It was one of the effects he was going for.
One thing, one observation I'd like to add to what you said about finding the music, I don't know, mean-spirited? Would that be going too far?
No, I think there's... I mean, I think maybe when it came to some of the sexual stuff, I kind of felt that a little bit. Like, maybe mean-spirited isn't exactly the tweaking I would put on it, but, like, sort of... not pleasurable or something.
Yeah. In addition to that, I think why it took me until I met Bob to get into Zappa, because I had an attraction for him early on as an interesting guy that I knew I should find out about. But I think because I identified with the values of the rock of the late 60s and 70s rock era.
Right.
He was doing satire on that, and I was identified with it. That was, you know, my passion, and he was satirizing it ruthlessly, which today I can appreciate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's kind of like a, and I think a lot of critics, when you go back and you read a lot of reviews of Frank Zappa, one of the constant things they're saying is, it's kind of like, the tone is sort of like, who the hell does he think he is? Like, he thinks he's better than this stuff he's make. Like, you know, there's this whole thing about him doing that little bit of Louie Louie on one of his records or something, and it's like, how dare he make fun of Louie Louie or something? It's become this, like, venerated rock classic or something. And, you know, I think, like, a lot of those 60s critics especially, they really, like, had a hard time kind of dealing with that. It was like he was, you know, he's pissing on everything they loved or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess he felt pissed on and he wasn't going to take it. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. But one last thing about Ben. I'm under the impression that Ben wrote for Rock Magazine in London.
The Wire, I think.
He was a rock critic, but he wasn't. Yeah.
He got fired. He was exactly like Meltzer. He wouldn't play the game. He would criticize and fuck up the ad flow, advertising revenue.
Oh.
So the question
I wanted to ask was he never established enough a reputation that you, Scott, as a rock journalist, you wouldn't run into him or you wouldn't know his name.
No. I mean, I have heard of him for sure. Like, I had heard of him even before the Bob stuff and that. Like I said, I saw the book, and I mean, I look, you know, there's
well, apart from the book, I just mean, you know, in terms of his writing for a magazine.
Yeah, yeah. You would, Scott Woods, you would know that he wrote for the Wire, right?
I might have known because I probably bought a bunch of Wire magazines. But I mean, I'm a little different in that way. I mean, quite frankly, I'm like, you know, I'm someone who touts rock criticism and I talk about it and I have a website about it. But I mean, I stopped reading the magazines themselves, really, probably 15, 20 years ago almost. Like, I mean, the internet, honestly, for me in that way was a boon because then suddenly people just started talking about the music again, and it was much more interesting to go to chat boards and hear people actually say stuff that, you know, like, most rock magazines have been deader than whatever to me for a long, long time. I was involved in a bunch of fanzines in the 90s, and they were, you know, there was a lot of activity happening there that was quite interesting. But, I mean, I never got off on Spin too much. I probably bought 100 issues and, you know, didn't really enjoy very many of them. And that was kind of like, it sort of died for me in that way. So.
And then you wouldn't have been reading The Wire when Ben was writing, you know, 10 years ago.
The Wire once, I see a magazine like The Wire and sometimes I would buy it because it was so out of my context of, you know, the American mags, and I could tell The Wire was obviously a much more kind of intellectual approach, and even though it kind of had this sort of a bit of a stodgy attitude towards some stuff, it's like, yeah, but at least they're going in depth about some of this stuff, and they'll take a kind of weird topic and they'll explore it. You know, they'll write about 100 records that they say set the world on fire, and you'll find out about a lot of stuff, you know, 30s like weird jazz records or something like that. So it's like there's something going on here that's at least their approach is interesting.
Right, but you're not reading it enough to notice Ben's name being repeated.
No, but as soon as I heard about his book and was intrigued by it, then, you know, he was someone who I thought about a lot. It's like, oh yeah, Ben Watson, he's the guy who did that Zappa book. I definitely want to check that out sometime. And I have read most of his book now, actually. I did end up buying a copy, so...
Yeah, as this conversation with Ben's turned out, I think we're doing a pretty incredible thing. And maybe this interview tonight can build on it, but nobody has talked about music the way we're doing it.
No, it's like it's the album of the year.
Yeah, that's a good headline. Write that to Ben.
It's album of the year. Yeah, in rock critic terms, you know, it's like
yeah. Because it's so surprising, not for Ben and I, but for anybody else, they never would have known what we're talking about. Never even knew of them.
Well, and Bob, I gotta say, I mean, I like one thing I really like about the Ben stuff. I mean, I listen to most of the James Martinez stuff as well. I'm addicted to that also.
Good.
But I like the Ben stuff, and I've told Dave this, but Ben, I don't know, there's something about him and you that's different than any of the other conversations. I mean, you would say you're different with everyone, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's more of a, like, Ben has this, like, oh, Bob, I don't, you know, that's bullshit.
Yeah, you're an idiot,
and
Bob.
So, like, and I like that. When he's kind of, like, mistrusting you, and he sometimes even just makes these sounds like, they kill me because he's like, I'm like, okay, Ben's like, Ben sort of like rolling his eyes right now. What's going to happen?
Which ammunition is he going to pull out? You know.
And Bob, that's almost going to lead into my first question. So I don't know if we're going.
Okay, we'll stop at that point. But I'll just say this: is that no one, on my tiny note chart, the Dobbs quadrant, each quadrant has a magazine. Well, the one in my quadrant is called, and it's based on that zine. It's called Ben is Dead. You know, it's incredible. My chart predicts these dialogues. And that was done back in 95. Ben is
dead. I remember that magazine, too. That
yeah. Ben is dead. So I was telling Ben that when he got sick a few months ago and he couldn't do anything for like weeks, 6 weeks.
Right.
I had to say, Ben, are you going to fulfill my chart? But he was too sick to really get what I was talking about. But I'll tell him again. But the thing is that he is the first person who is as learned as I am in what I'm sort of an expert on. There's no one who's ever known what he knows about what I know. The point, what's interesting, is he has the exact opposite take on it as a Marxist, you know?
Yeah, okay.
This is the debate of the 21st century, you know what I mean?
He's a materialist.
Yeah, and I'm hard to categorize, but he knew nothing about McLuhan. I knew a little bit about Marx, but by reading his books before, you know, Art and Culture, which is a really good book, Art, Culture, and Cleavage, I think it is. Art,
right, yeah.
That's a really good book, and it has all kinds of obscure Trotskyist literature. So I learned a lot about the school of thought that Ben celebrates. And, of course, it fit into McLuhanism, as I'm trying to tell him. But so I learned a lot about his world. He's learned a lot about my world, and that's what's unique.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
While talking about Frank, I mean, someday I hope Gail Zappa hears this, because she likes to be an intellectual. This stuff will either drive up the wall or she'd be intrigued, because this is the way she thinks Frank should be treated, in a way.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
I mean, up with the greats, you know? And the ornery greats, like Wyndham Lewis and Joyce. I mean, these are people know of them, but they don't read them. They're not going to read them. They know of Frank. They're not going to listen to him.
Yep.
So, and McLuhan. No one ever read McLuhan. And certainly Dobbs, the greatest thinker of our time. Nobody fucking paid attention to me.
And you want it that way, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm more effective that way, because if you really knew what I was doing, man, I'd be arrested a long time ago. Actually, I have been arrested. I'm here in lockdown here in Maui, but it's a nice place to do it. Okay, so I think it's really, really good that I'm glad I went and looked up Ben, you know, when I went to London in April of 2008.
Okay, yeah.
And it's changed his life. I mean, he changed his radio show after interacting with me and brought his daughter on. He used to write, he writes his stuff out and then he reads it, but he got more into just sort of loosening up and improvising instead of following his script so much. And
then
that allowed Iris and his son Mordecai to be part of it. So I don't listen to his radio show immediately, but eventually I go and catch up on them, but they're pretty good. He has incredible eclectic taste. He has, you know, good stuff he finds that he plays.
Yeah, No, I've listened to a few of them. I like them as well, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, Ben's a good guy, and okay, so I think Scott, we're, Mr. Norris, I think we're ready.
Okay.
I'll just do one hoik up. Now, Ben, I always hoik up before the show, before I do the thing with Ben, and he can hear me on the Skype, so he's always laughing, and he actually taped one of them, and one of, like, you know, number, Ben, bomb Ben number two or three, you hear me spitting up. And so that's on the tape. But just a minute. I like to not have mucus in my mouth.
We didn't hear a single thing that time, Bob.
I know. I put on mute. I know technology. I know how to recover privacy.
Oh, it used to be part of the feeling of the Bob warm-up to be able to hear you do that.
Yes, Mike Dyer, when we used to do CKLN, we'd be on the thing and getting ready. The top of the hour, midnight promos would be on, and I'd be off in the side room, you know, hoiking up into the garbage can. And Mike would be very, you know, tolerant and calm, just waiting for me to finish. And then it's always been there from the beginning. I hate that sound where someone's talking and their mucus is in there and they kind of start trying to cough, but they can't cough because they got to finish the sentence. I hate that.
Got to finish, yeah.
So I might get to that point, but I'm not going to encourage it. Okay, so how do we, is this?
So what's the date today, Bob?
November 8th.
9th.
Oh, Jesus, 9th. Yeah, see, November 7th is Nelson Stahl's birthday, 1952. Art McKay, another Club 22 guy in Nova Scotia, his birthday is the next day. So he's, Art and Nelson are within 24 hours of each other, like Gerd Stern and Don Thiel. Did you listen to Gerd Stern part, Scott?
No, I'm looking forward to it. When I was sampling it, just to make sure I had the right clip, I heard his voice, and it was really fun.
Yeah, he, there's other people there, so he doesn't get to talk as much, but he has some good stuff to say when he gets a chance. Okay, so, what was I just saying?
And that was recorded live recently?
Yeah, that was last Thursday.
Oh, so he's out of the hospital or whatever his thing was.
Yeah, he's been out of the hospital for months, but he's not fully back. And Carolyn talked to him a bit. I don't know what that led to, but he's still alive as of last Thursday.
Oh, cool.
So,
hey guys, sorry to interrupt. I'm just thinking about my own throat. I'm just going to slip away for like 20 seconds, grab a water, okay?
Okay.
One sec.
So, so Scott, what were we just saying about our, so it's November 9th. Okay, so I have to ask Scott Woods if he's, he may intro this if it's his thing. You know what I mean? His
no, you always
his magazine. No, it might be his magazine. If he wants to intro it,
oh, okay,
his, he can do it.
All right.
So, Scott Woods, since this might be used by you on your Rock Critic site, you can do the intro. You know,
sure,
it doesn't have to be too long, but just say a few words or context and say this is part two. This is a rematch. What do you call it? Rematch? What did they say? Return bout.
if I
prequel. Were
clever enough, I'd make it kind of like Lester Bangs meeting Lou Reed for the third time.
Everyone was
like a new sort of, you know, round in the battle kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. And because art, science, media, and nature have converged under electric conditions, we won't know who's Lester Bangs and who's Lou Reed.
Yeah.
Because you can claim to be a musician, you do DJing.
What's that? I can what?
You can claim to be a musician. You do DJing.
That's right.
So the, were you shocked when Lester Bangs died, when you heard about it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I was living in London, Ontario then, and we actually used to get the Village Voice, which was kind of bizarre. It was actually showed up there for a few years. And yeah, I was pretty blown away when I heard that news, yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing the article that week. It was about April 82, I remember.
That's right. Exactly.
Opening it up.
Bob, how do you remember that?
I know that, you know, like you can, people have different kinds of sticky tape in their minds, and I'm a sticky dates, but I cannot remember how songs go.
Ah, okay.
I can't say, I have a new alibi though. Ben and I came up with a new alibi. We can't remember songs because 90% of it is fucking crap, but if I like the song, I can remember it. Like Zappa. We got dog ears. It doesn't register on us.
Okay, Bob, how does Inca Roads go?
Oh, I could. That's a postgraduate. It has to be on. Here's the point. It has to be on, and I can sing along with it. But if it's something that's not really great, or I can't even say that. Forget what my alibi. Most things, it's on. I can't even remember what the song is as it's on. You know what I mean? Like, I can't sing along. I don't remember what it was. But Zappa, I can sing along with. I know where it goes.
Huh. It left an imprint. Other stuff is just dust.
And so the point is, I've got no acoustic memory on the ear level, but I've got a real good tribal memory, oral culture memory for visual facts and dates. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
So I'm left hemisphere in my oral tribalism, and Dave Neufeld is right hemisphere in his oral tribalism, right?
Yeah.
So anyways, that's just my little quirk. See, I used to always add up numbers since I was young. And one of my first big eurekas was to find out that every, and this was really young, was to find out that any number multiplied by nine, the product adds up to nine. Wow! A constant in a universe in a century of chaos. A constant has been found.
any number multiplied by nine?
Yeah.
Wow.
9 elevens is 99. That's 9 and 9 is 18. 1 and 8 is 9.
Cool.
So I'm a fanatic about, I'm just naturally can remember dates, but I can remember, also I can, I got a good tactile memory, I can remember the mood or something, I can remember a lot of my life. Like I know what I did in May 1982, a month after Bangs, and not for any public reason.
Wow. You know,
just I know every day of my life.
Bob's wake.
Yeah, so when I was reading these articles, it was like, oh, yeah, I remember those days.
Coming back to you, yeah.
Yeah. Bob's wake, right. Okay, so you introduce it how, as if it was going to be on the Rock Critics site, which it could go up. That's still functioning, right?
Yeah, I mean, whether it will go up as, I mean, it'll probably go up initially as an MP3, I guess, or a couple MP3s or whatever. And then transcription would, you know, if it happens, would be somewhat down the road.
Obviously. Oh, yeah, I don't care about transcription.
Okay, good.
But the this can be, it doesn't have to be all done tonight.
Okay, no, that's good.
So there's no pressure if we get really wandering off on a whole digression, that's okay, because there's no time limit.
Good. I'm good with that.
Okay, good. Okay, so we'll let you... let you start off, Scott. So let's hear it, Norris.
Okay.
All right, this is Scott Woods.
No. Yes, go 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, I'll count down from 3 to 1 and then say go.